Support for WPR comes from WIPS with Toward One Wisconsin, a conference on equity, diversity, and inclusion, May 7th and 8th in Eau Claire. Registration information and more is at t1w.org.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, from suicide attempts to withholding of medications by staff, we'll hear how Wisconsin inmates describe their experience in solitary confinement.
First, according to data from Pew Research in 2015, women throughout the United States earned 83% of what men earned. That wage gap gets more drastic when race is factored into the equation.
And there are long-term issues with the wage gap. Namely, the buying power of women is reduced and requires women to work more to close that gap. This impact extends to families and children.
Vicki Shabo joins us now. She's vice president at the National Partnership for Women and Families, a nonprofit that advocates for women in a number of arenas, including equal pay. They recently took a look at the data and calculated the long-term effects the wage gap can have on women and families, and they look at the way those disparities play out in states like Wisconsin. Vicki, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Rob. It's great to be with you.
Well, we touched briefly on the Pew data about the wage gap nationally. Talk a little more about that, though. What do these differences look like?
Well, so here at the National Partnership, we did an analysis for Equal Pay Day last week and found that, on average, women who work full-time year-round in the United States earn $40,742 compared to $51,212 for a typical man, which means that overall women in the U.S. are paid 80 cents for every dollar paid to man on an annual basis, which amounts to an annual gender wage gap of more than $10,400.
Now, there's a lot of argument out there about the causes. Some people are saying this is mostly gender discrimination accounting for this gap. Other people saying it's different career paths for men and women, in a shortened nutshell of the argument there. Can you talk about some of the causes behind this disparity in pay?
Well, there are a number of causes of the wage gap. Of course, women and men often choose different types of jobs. Women are more often cycling in and out of the workforce or facing career interruptions because they still have a disproportionate share of caregiving responsibilities. And so there are many different factors, but even when all of those factors are controlled for, when you control for education, race, occupation, region of the country, all of those identifiable factors, there's still close to 40% of that gap that is unexplained. And researchers that have looked at this over the years chalk that up to both implicit bias and really overt discrimination.
And what do things look like here in Wisconsin? You broke this down by state. How do we stack up when it comes to the wage gap?
So Wisconsin falls pretty close to the middle, just above average. The gap in Wisconsin is 22 cents, which means that women on average are paid 78 cents for every dollar paid to men, which amounts to an annual gap of about $10,700. So not great, but not as bad as some other states out there.
And you also looked at how this breaks down by race. So how do Black and Latino women fare nationally, and if you have the data, by state here in Wisconsin when it comes to the wage gap?
Yeah, so in the United States, Black women who hold full-time year-round jobs are paid typically 63 cents for every dollar paid to a white non-Hispanic man. Latinas are paid 54 cents for every dollar paid to white non-Hispanic men. In Wisconsin, Black women fare just a little bit under average, 62 cents for every dollar paid to white non-Hispanic men. Latinas are paid 53 cents. So that's about average overall, a little bit worse than nationwide. Asian women in Wisconsin, though, notably, are paid 64 cents for every dollar paid to white non-Hispanic men, compared to nationally, where the average is 85 cents. So there is where we start to see some pretty dramatic drop-off and really need to start to ask what's going on there, whether it's occupations or something else.
Talking to Vicki Shabo from the National Partnership for Women and Families, looking at the wage disparities between men and women nationally and here in Wisconsin. And Vicki, you went a step beyond in some of your recent analysis, beyond the wage gap itself, and looked at the outcome, what it means for women and for families. So what did you find?
That's right. And this is where it gets real. We found that on average, if the annual wage gap were eliminated in Wisconsin, so looking specifically at your state, a typical woman could afford 13 additional months of childcare, more than a year of tuition and fees at a four-year public university, or the full cost of tuition and fees at a two-year community college. That one always gets me, the full cost of tuition and fees at a two-year community college. 79 more weeks of food for her family, more than a year and a half's worth of food. 8 more months of mortgage and utility payments, or over one additional year of rent. So when you start to look at it that way, it isn't just about cents on the dollar, but really about the ability of women to provide for themselves and their families on an ongoing basis. And that is just incredibly sobering, and really creates some urgency around solving this problem.
Right. And this is something that accumulates over a lifetime, over the course of a career.
That's right. That's right. Some research done by a colleague organization of ours put the annual, the lifetime cost of the wage gap at close to $500,000 for women overall.
And you also start to look at possible solutions. And here it seems like there's a wide variety of things. Let's look at things that tackle kind of overt or close to overt gender discrimination when it comes to wages. What kind of things could help tackle that part of the problem?
Well, one of the solutions that's out there is called the Paycheck Fairness Act, and this is a federal proposal. It was just reintroduced on Equal Pay Day the week before last, but has been introduced many other times and has passed the House of Representatives in the past, and this would start to tighten up some of the excuses that are provided by employers about why they are paying women differently or people of color differently. It would give women the ability and all people the ability to discuss wages in their workplace, their compensation with coworkers and colleagues without fear of retaliation or adverse consequences on the job. It would reduce the use or limit the use of prior salary history in hiring and compensation determinations, and it would provide tools both to employers and employees that would help them to counter some of that implicit bias that might exist, to help them understand fair compensation practices and give individual employees better tools for negotiating their pay.
I've seen that salary history issue come up a lot lately. The idea there, tell me if I have this right, is that if we've got this uneven system now and we base future salaries on that uneven system, we're just going to keep replicating this on out into the future. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So if women are graduating to a pay gap from college, and we know from some data that's out there that is what's happening, that there's about a 9-cent gap or so just right out of college, and you think about how prior salary is then used in future job negotiations or in future hiring decisions, you're just compounding that initial disparity, and it just grows over time. And that's part of what contributes to, you know, calculations about the annual or lifetime wage gaps.
Getting into another cause of the wage difference, you mentioned earlier that women are in our society more prone to maybe take time off of work, either to go part-time or leave the workforce for a while for family reasons, and that is part of the cause here. But your organization says more family-friendly workplace policies might help address that cause as well.
That's right. So we work here on things like paid family and medical leave and paid sick days, which makes it possible for people to take time away from their jobs to care for themselves and their loved ones, both for routine illnesses in the case of paid sick days and for more serious family and medical needs, whether the birth of a new child or adoption of a new child, or to care for a seriously ill family member or for one's own serious health condition, and for military families to be able to deal with those exigencies arising from a family member's deployment. Particularly around childbirth and caregiving for family members, we know that when women don't, and men don't, have paid leave, but especially women, because they are the ones who are more often doing the caregiving, that they are more likely to leave the workforce. And in contrast, when women have access to paid leave around the birth of a child, they are more likely to be working 9 to 12 months later. They are more likely to earn higher wages. And both women and men are less likely to use public assistance or food stamps or SNAP in the year following a child's birth. Similarly, at the other end of the spectrum, women and men who leave the workforce to care for an aging parent lose more than $300,000 in income and retirement savings on average. So we're talking here about, you know, people cycling out of work rather than being able to stay attached to work when they have some ability to take time off. And it's really contributing to the overall health of the economy as well.
We're talking to Vicki Szabo right now. She's vice president at the National Partnership for Women and Families. That's a nonprofit that advocates for women, for pay equity, and more. She's talking to us now about the gender wage gap, causes and solutions, both in Wisconsin and nationwide.
And you can join our conversation. Are you affected by the wage gap? Do you see gender discrimination in your line of work? And what do you think needs to be done to close that wage gap? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment over on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation now about the gender wage gap, disparities between what men and women make on the job. We're talking with Vicki Szabo. She's vice president at the National Partnership for Women and Families.
And you can join the conversation. Do you feel as though you've experienced the gender wage gap? What do you see as the causes and maybe the solutions for different pay scales for men and women? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Vicki, this is an issue that people have been talking about for a number of years now. Are things changing? Has this gap narrowed much over the years?
The gap has narrowed very, very, very slowly. So back in 1963, I believe that women were paid 59 cents for every dollar paid to men. We're now up to 80 cents. Within the last 5 years, it's gone from 77 to 80. So at this rate, researchers predict that the wage gap will not close until close to 2060. So we've got to have some interventions here because our women and families are really suffering as a result of the wage gap.
And I looked, you broke down the wage gap, not just by state, but also by congressional district. One thing that struck me about Wisconsin, the narrowest wage gap, the thing that was closest was in the greater Milwaukee area. But it looked like that was because the overall wage, the wages of men were lower on average than the rest of the country. So that was kind of narrowing it, but not in a way that anybody's going to be celebrating.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And you're correct. Wisconsin 4, women are paid 90 cents for every dollar paid to men who work full-time year-round. But yeah, the overall wages for men in Milwaukee are much lower, just $41,000 typically a year compared to women's $37,000 or so. And what we, you know, what working families really need is to raise wages altogether, and that means raising the minimum wage, which will help to boost wages overall. It means the kinds of family-friendly policies that also boost the economy that we've been talking about, like paid sick days and paid family and medical leave. It means more full-time jobs and not so much use of part-time jobs that often have very unpredictable, inflexible schedules that make it hard for people to hold a second job or get more education or even figure out a stable childcare arrangement. So there are lots of different interventions in addition to, obviously, things like the Paycheck Fairness Act, which would address the discrimination that still exists.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Teddy is with us in Washington, D.C. Teddy, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Hi, I think I certainly agree with the federal pay provisions, and I think the a predominant factor in this is the fact that women are much more likely to take time off to nurture and care for children than men are, and that takes time away from their careers. And I think along with not just an increased minimum wage, but a living wage across the board federally, in addition to a federal legislation which provides family leave for both men and women, will both assist with nurturing for the next generation, as well as equalizing the pay gap.
Teddy, thanks for the call. Vicki, some of the ideas you talked about there, but paid family leave for men and women might go a long way, he says, to help narrow the gap.
Absolutely, and I'm so glad that that Teddy brought that up. The policies that we support are absolutely gender neutral. They apply equally to women and men. That's always been a cornerstone of the kinds of policies we've supported back to 1993 when we were instrumental in passing the Family and Medical Leave Act, which provides unpaid job protected leave, but absolutely. At the same time as we need to recognize that women are still doing a disproportionate share of caregiving, we also need to recognize and celebrate that when men have access to leave, they are more likely to take that time. And, you know, research out there shows that when men do take time to care for a new child, for example, women's wages actually go up as well. So absolutely, gender-neutral time is critical to the kind of equality and equity that we're seeking with respect to pay.
Thanks for the call, Teddy. We're talking to Vicki Szabo from the National Partnership for Women and Families, looking at the pay gap between men and women. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 as an employee or an employer. How do things work at your workplace? Are things transparent? Do you know if there's a pay gap where you work? We'll go back to our callers now. Carl is with us in Madeline Island. Carl, hi.
Hey, how are you doing this afternoon?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Carl?
Well, I have two daughters, and one's finishing grad school this month, and another is a junior in college. And, you know, during their dating lives, I've got a kind of a litmus test for the guys they're with that they're starting to get serious about, and ask them if they feel that there should be legislation guaranteeing equal pay for genders.
And what kind of answers do you get?
Well, sometimes I get the answer I want. Sometimes I get no answer. And sometimes I think that they're pulling the wool over my eyes, or trying to.
They're across the board on that, huh?
Yeah, pretty much, yes. So, but that's just my comment. And thanks for this topic.
Carl, thanks for the call. Vicki, do you see public support for some of the policies you're talking about?
Absolutely. There is overwhelming public support for each of the policy proposals that we've talked about here. Equal pay, something that is really non-controversial among voters, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. Same is true of paid family and medical leave. Some recent research that we did just in conjunction with the election showed close to 8 in 10 voters that support a national paid family and medical leave law that would allow women and men time to care for a new child, a seriously ill loved one, or their own serious health condition, including 2/3 of Republicans and more than 3/4 of independents. So these policies are not controversial. Democrats and Republicans know that fair pay is essential to economic security and to fairness. They know that whether you're, you know, regardless of your party identification, people need time to be there with their loved ones when it counts the most and to care for themselves.
Carl, thanks for that call from up on Madeline Island. We'll go next to Darlene with us in Green Bay. Darlene, hi.
Hi. My comment is that years ago, men were expected to earn more than women because they were supporting family. But in today's world, I'm guessing 90% of single-parent families are headed by women. And besides that, they have child care to pay for. And I've never heard anyone mention that discrepancy, too.
Darlene, thanks for the call. Vicki, I don't know about the number, but more women likely to be heads of single-parent households, and that creates, obviously, economic challenges.
That's right. I mean, I think, you know, the overarching story that the data tells and the reality for most people is that most children are growing up in households where, whether it's a single parent or two parents, those parents are working. They are contributing to the family's economic situation and well-being. 2/3 of moms are key breadwinners in families. So, you know, these outdated notions, you know, we often hear these stories from not even that long ago that of overt discrimination where employers say to a woman, well, you're not supporting a family, so I'm not going to pay you as much. That's really the leave it to beaver era gone by. Today, whether it's a single parent, and there are an increasing number of single parent households usually headed by women, or whether it's two parent families, folks are working hard to get by, and wage disparities really only exacerbate economic difficulties that families are having.
Darlene, thanks for that call. Vicki, I understand some people are advocating for more equal pay, say part of the problem is not enough information within a particular company or within a particular industry. There's a lot of data we don't have, and there have been efforts to track that so we know, and the leaders of a company, for that matter, know whether they have a problem with this.
That's right. And one of the good things that we're seeing from some leading companies is voluntary pay audits that are being conducted so that companies are looking at their own pay practices. We need to go a step further, though. One of the things that the Obama administration did before leaving office was finalize a data compensation collection report that the Equal Opportunity Employment Commission is to put into effect beginning this year with data that has to be reported by companies at the beginning of next year. We're starting to see that under attack by large, well-heeled organizations like the Chamber of Commerce and some other organized, relatively conservative business organizations. We actually need people to be speaking out with the Office of Management and Budget and with the EEOC saying that we want that compensation data to be collected. It would be collected by gender, race, and ethnicity for different types of occupations or positions within a company, and that will allow employers themselves to identify and correct discriminatory or just unequal pay practices, whether there's motive behind it or not, and also allow the EEOC and the Department of Labor to better target investigations and enforcement of existing equal pay laws for companies and especially for federal contractors.
You know, for a woman out there listening who's in the workforce, all this nationwide data might sound interesting and disturbing. But for that woman in the workforce, is there advice out there to, negotiate a higher salary to close some of these gaps?
Yeah, I mean, definitely, you know, there are best practices for negotiation, but you have to keep in mind that not everybody feels comfortable advocating or safe within their workplace. There are some protections under the National Labor Relations Act for people who are getting together to talk about their pay for the purpose of bringing it up in their workplace, for banding together. But often, you know, the balance of power really lies with employers, and particularly for lower wage workers who don't feel that they have a lot of bargaining power, it's very difficult to raise the issue of fair pay. And part of what the Paycheck Fairness Act would do is clarify and strengthen the protections that exist for workers that do find out about or want to discuss their pay with their coworkers.
Vicki, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for tackling this important topic.
That's Vicki Szabo from the National Partnership for Women and Families. She joined us today to talk about the gender wage gap in Wisconsin and around the nation.
As the national discussion about prison reform continues, solitary confinement has gotten more and more criticism. The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism just released the results of their in-depth look at the effects of long-term solitary confinement on inmates in Wisconsin.
In particular, the report looks at administrative confinement, the use of solitary confinement without a definite end date. Reporters surveyed 65 inmates in the state held in solitary confinement, some for more than 20 years.
Dee Hall joins us now. She's managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. She worked on the story along with Alexandra Arriaga and University of Wisconsin-Madison People intern Carly Waits. Dee, good to have you back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, you surveyed 65 inmates in Wisconsin about their experience in administrative confinement. What kinds of things did you ask them?
Well, we wanted to know, so just to back up a little bit, we decided to do the survey at a point where there were several inmates on hunger strike, and they were primarily hunger striking to protest long-term solitary confinement, including administrative confinement. So my husband, Andy Hall, who runs the investigative center, said, well, let's just survey them. It took us months to pull the whole thing together, not just the surveys, but we did a multimedia package. So we asked them things like, what's your everyday life like? Have you ever been denied medications that you were prescribed? What is your mental health status? Things of that nature. We wanted to know what it was like behind those solid walls.
And you conducted these surveys by mail. They were not done in person. Can you talk about why that was?
Well, we wanted to talk to face-to-face, or at least on the phone, men in administrative confinement, but we were unable to arrange that through the Department of Corrections. That's why we went the route of a mail-in survey. I was able to interview one long-term solitary confinement resident. That was LaRon McKinley. He had been in solitary for nearly 28 years, but after the hunger strike, he and prison officials reached an agreement where he went to the Wisconsin Resource Center, which is for mentally ill inmates.
And we have some dramatization that you put together based on the responses that you received from these surveys. But before we get to that, could you give us just a broad overview of what kind of picture these inmates painted about their time in this long-term solitary confinement?
Well, when you talk about the daily life, a lot of them were able to, you know, occupy their time by reading, working on prison lawsuits, listening to radios or watching television if they had that level if they were able to have that type of property. But a lot of them just talked about, you know, being very extraordinarily lonely, being very, you know, they felt that whatever mental health issues they had were getting exacerbated. And so it was a pretty grim picture that they painted.
And again, we have a bit of a dramatization. There's more online about these responses, but here's a little bit of what you put together.
I'm left to rot on administrative confinement with no hope of getting off. They always tell us keep doing good, then laugh at us. They've been doing this for years.
I haven't left my cell in months. I lay in bed all the time and do nothing.
They make us live in cells that have had feces in them for months, to the point where it's part of the paint on the wall.
I've requested to see a psychologist, but they don't bother to see me, so I've learned it's better not to ask for help.
I have no choice but to listen to people screaming, banging on their doors, or otherwise making noise. I think about what I'd do to those people if these doors would open.
No one cares if I live or die.
And again, these are the actual words, I understand it, that you got back on these surveys. And one thing you heard quite a bit about in the surveys, Dee, was suicide attempts. Can you talk about what happens to an inmate in administrative confinement when they have tried to commit suicide?
Yeah, so that was one piece of the story that we used. We talked with a former Waupun psychologist, Bradley Boyven. He had left the DOC essentially having real problems with the way that the inmates with mental health were being treated. One of the things that they have is called observation. So if an inmate is self-harming, either has tried to harm himself or has made threats to do that, he is placed in a cell that's in the segregation, in the solitary block, he can either wear a paper smock or another garment that keeps them from harming themselves, or at times they have nothing on at all except a little washcloth to cover themselves. And, you know, they have no property. They have nothing to do. In extreme cases, they're tied down. It's called an 8-point restraint. So shoulders and knees and hands and legs. And, you know, it's a very, very grim, you know, status for a person to be in. And that was one of the things that Boyven had talked to us about, the psychologist, was that it was like an animal being tied down. It was very, very hard to be around that.
We're speaking with Dee Hall right now from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, talking about new research, new study from the center, looking at the effects of long-term solitary confinement on inmates in Wisconsin. And Dee, another concern that came up in these surveys was the withholding of medication. And this is something that some of these inmates had said it was used as sort of a punitive practice. And there are different accounts of this happening. What did you hear there?
So there were a couple dozen inmates who said that at various times, either it had happened to them or they could hear sort of everything going on in the block. They'd heard it happen to somebody else where medication was withheld. Last year, the Department of Corrections fired one person. One person retired, and I think the other one resigned after they were taped doing that exact thing of taunting an inmate with mental illness and saying they were going to refuse to give him his medication. And so when we talked to Dr. Boyven, he said that he would often hear this from inmates, is that somebody was withholding medication. And, you know, he didn't know what to believe until he actually saw it himself one time where a correctional official had threatened to withhold medication from one of the inmates, and he issued a complaint about that.
And is it the the guards themselves who are administering like they have been in Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake?
Yeah, so that's an interesting situation. The governor in his budget has proposed several million, at least $1 million to hire more people who are medically trained to issue the medications, to hand out the medications at Lincoln Hills and Copper Lake, which is the juvenile prison system. In the adult system, however, it's still handled by untrained medical staff, which, according to the DOC's own budget documents, is an unacceptable practice.
And in terms of why someone would be placed in this long-term, open-ended type of situation of called administrative confinement, not solitary, but administrative, what kinds of things are going to find a person in that situation?
So this is considered a, quote, non-punitive status, although the people in it will disagree with that. The idea is that these people are potentially harmful to staff, to other inmates, or to the smooth running of the institution. So people who are considered gang leaders can end up there. Folks who have had multiple assaults of inmates or staff can land there. And those tend to be the people who are, placed in administrative confinement.
And when it's open-ended like that, meaning you don't know how long you'll be there or when that experience might end, did you get a sense of what effect that has on the inmate that's going through it?
Well, there's that complete uncertainty. You don't know when or if you'll ever get out of it. Now, I know that the state will say that they have a step program where you can work your way out if you behave. But there have been inmates, including LaRon McKinley, who has filed a federal lawsuit against the prison system, who say that the longer they're in solitary, the less they are able to conform their behavior to what they need to get out of it. So it's sort of a perpetual situation. And in his case, he said the way he described it in his lawsuit, there's no bright line criterion for how he can work his way out of that.
And what kind of mental health care is available for inmates who are in solitary confinement long term like this?
It's pretty sparse overall. They have these very short check-ins where the door stays shut. The inmate stays on one side and the mental health providers on the other side. They say, hey, how are you doing? The problem with that is that everybody around that inmate can hear it, so it's not a confidential setting. So a lot of inmates do not participate in that.
And it's through the door?
It's through the door. So, it's not even a face-to-face check-in, really. There are opportunities for inmates to leave the solitary confinement unit and go into another secured place where they can meet with the psychologist one-on-one. But what Dr. Boivin told us is that was discouraged sometimes by the security staff, who felt like they just didn't want to deal with having to, extract this person from the cell for that purpose.
Dee Hall is with us right now in the studio talking about a new report from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism looking at the effects of long-term solitary confinement called administrative confinement on inmates in Wisconsin.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What kind of policy would you like to see Wisconsin have when it comes to long-term solitary confinement? And is this an issue that has touched your life in some way? Have you or a family member had experience with solitary confinement? Do you work in corrections? How do you see this working where you work or worked in the past? And what kind of questions do you have about this survey of people who have lived through this administrative confinement? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about the effects of solitary confinement on inmates in Wisconsin. Dee Hall is in the studio with us now. She's managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism and one of the authors of that new report.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has this affected your life? Have you or a family member had experience with solitary confinement? What is that experience like? If you've worked in a prison, what do you think about the role of administrative confinement, solitary confinement? Is it overused? Is it a necessary tool? What would you like to see Wisconsin adopt as a policy when it comes to solitary confinement? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We have Phyllis joining us in Clark County. Phyllis, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask?
Yes, my question is, the people that are getting mental health treatment in our prisons, did they come into the institution with a mental health illness, or did the illness develop as they were incarcerated? Now, I worked in a county hospital, in the county hospital system in the 70s, and this isolation thing was abolished from people with mental illness way back then, unless there were really extreme conditions where you had to have a medical or doctor's sign orders for any type of that type of segregation. So I'm just wondering, are we making people sick, or are we contributing to their illness, and why are we incarcerating people who are mentally ill?
Phyllis, thank you for that question. Do you have any insight into that, Dean?
Sure. So there were some of the survey respondents who said that they went in there without a mental illness and they felt they developed it as a result of the isolation. There were others who said they already had conditions and that this status exacerbated those conditions. So it is both situations that we found in our survey.
Phyllis, thank you for that call. And we'll go next to Mary joining us in Ashland. Mary, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to share?
Well, I recently joined a group of people up in Ashland who are writing letters to prisoners. And I received a fairly amazing letter from somebody who's been in solitary confinement for 18 years in here in Wisconsin. And this was very hard for me to believe. So I looked it up online and found out, indeed, he has been in that long, and some other people have been in as long as 27 years. And I am completely appalled by this situation, and I'm wondering why do we allow this to happen in Wisconsin, and how do we compare to other states?
Mm-hmm. Mary, thank you for that and for sharing your experience communicating with someone who has been going through administrative long-term solitary confinement. And Mary was surprised that this has been happening, that someone could be in solitary confinement for that long. What do we know about how Wisconsin stacks up when it comes to other states?
Well, we do know that some states are beginning to cease the practice of long-term solitary confinement because of the very issues that we've been talking about here, the exacerbation of mental health issues. Also, behaviorally, it doesn't necessarily, in many cases, it's a disciplinary, it's sort of a control mechanism, but it can have the opposite effect, as you can imagine, as people get very frustrated and lonely and disturbed by being in this extreme isolation for so long. So, yes, I can confirm you're probably thinking of LaRon McKinley when you said 27 years. That's about how long he was in solitary. He's now at the Wisconsin Resource Center. That's why I was able to interview him. But there is a national movement away from solitary, in Wisconsin, we've also reduced the use of solitary confinement. We had, I think, something around 1,300 people in solitary just a few years ago, and we're now down between 900 and 1,000. And of that, there's a subsection in administrative confinement that's between 90 and about 100 at any given time are in administrative confinement.
I want to ask you, what recourse might someone have if they have been in for one of these extended periods of time? Is there any sort of formal appeals process for an inmate?
Well, they do review them every 6 months or every year to see whether they should still be in administrative confinement. Frankly, that we've seen this in Wisconsin. We've seen it in other states. There are certain individuals who simply languish in that status for decades sometimes. And there are ways for them to work their way out of it, but there are some people for whom they are still concerned for the safety of other people when they're out in the general population, and they're worried about the smooth running of the institution, so they remain in that status.
Let's take another call now. We have John joining us in Shawano. John, hi.
Hi. So sorry, I missed most of your program today. I'm sure it's a very important topic, though. I used to work for 5 years at Ethan Allen School, Juvenile Secure Detention Facility in Wales, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And even though I'm a smaller guy, I worked in security units most of the time, only because I could talk the guys down quite a bit. But I totally believe in segregating and isolating individuals that need to be away from the general population, if you get my drift there. It is completely it's for the safety of everybody. And
John, could you expand on that a little? You said you believe in segregating and isolating for the good of everybody. What good did you see?
People getting broken into fights almost to the death. You need to segregate individual that's under custody, but in the most humane way possible. But you need to segregate. There are some people that just need to be put in a different room away from the general population.
John, thanks a lot for sharing that insight. And John saying he does see the benefits, and he's not the only one to make this case that this is a necessary tool to use in corrections. And I know, Dee, that you also wrote about the state looking to move toward what's called a 10-10 model, so that maybe there's some modifications to the way solitary is used. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So the 10-10 model is something that's in use in Colorado, and it allows inmates out instead of in Wisconsin. If you're in solitary, you can get out as few as 4 hours a week out of your cell. This allows 10 of recreation and 10 of therapy or programming related to mental health issues. And so that allows 20 hours out of cell for individuals who, even if they're in a solitary placement. I will say that I hope our articles reflected the difficulty that prison officials have, because there are people who are dangerous to others. And so the question is, how do you manage that without making them worse, even more violent? There was one man who we surveyed. He admitted that if they let him in general population, he would have no problem harming a correctional officer. He randomly stabbed a man. He wasn't sure who he was, a fellow inmate. And the longer he's in solitary, the more angry and violent he becomes.
Well, thank you for that insight. And let's move on to another call now. Bill is joining us next in Janesville. Bill, hello.
Hi there. I wonder how many are in solitary based on protective measures, and if that were eliminated, how that would change things, in your view?
Bill, thank you for that. Dee?
That's a really good question, and we didn't look at people who are in protective custody. I don't think it's a large number, but that is a status you can be placed in if there's a concern that you might be harmed by somebody else in the prison system, where you're taken out of the general population and set and placed in this kind of setting so that other inmates can't get to you.
And Dee, as we wrap up, less than a minute here, but you've been talking about how you were able to interview in person one inmate who spent nearly 3 decades, LaRon McKinley. He was in administrative confinement. What did he tell you? What were your takeaways from that interview?
Well, he has a lawsuit right now against the state of Wisconsin, and he is claiming that this long-term isolation has really made it difficult for him to deal with people in a normal way anymore. It's made it hard for him to conform his behavior to a point where he might be able to get out of administrative confinement. He just said it's a very psychologically damaging state, and he believes that it violates the Constitution, a prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment.
Dee, thanks a lot for coming by the studio and sharing your research with us today.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Dee Halla is managing editor at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism, joining us to talk about the center's new report detailing the effects reported by Wisconsin inmates about their experience with long-term solitary confinement.